wpfw.org. Thanks.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to Member Supported WPFW Washington.
Millions of women are being thrown under the bus when it comes to working conditions in America. We'll talk with Caroline Fredrickson, author of Under the Bus. She knows all too well the laws that exploit women because she helped to write them. And it seems like every other day another unarmed black man shot and killed by police. Finally, somebody's documenting cop killings. The creator of the website, The Count It, joins us this morning later on What's at Stake. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, we have a special edition of What's at Stake this morning. It's special not only because of the guests that we have on board, but also because we're in the middle of our summer mini drive. And we should start off by thank you to one of our listeners who is renewing her pledge on Katia Stitt's program this morning, Allison Glick. Thank you so much for your support. And you, the rest of the listeners will have an opportunity to pledge their support as well. But, you know, conditions for millions of working women in America haven't really changed that much since the 19th century. That sounds like hyperbole, but unfortunately, it's no exaggeration. Yes, of course, there have been some progress for women in the work world. A tiny percentage of women are CEOs and top executives. Some have managed to break through the glass ceiling. And, of course, we could very well have a woman for president, depending on how the 2016 election turns out. But at the end of the workday, women are still paid 78 cents for every dollar her white male counterpart is paid for doing the same job. Unless, of course, you're a black woman, then you're only paid 64 cents for every dollar a white male counterpart gets, and Latinas only 54 cents. And when we look at the overall work condition, the wage gap is just the tip of the exploitation iceberg. Our guest this morning, Caroline Fredrickson, is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Ms. Fredrickson is president of the American Constitution Society and a senior fellow at Demos. She served as director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office. She's worked on the Hill as chief of staff to Senator Maria Cantwell and deputy chief of staff to Democrats leader Tom Daschle. During the Clinton administration, Caroline Fredrickson was special assistant to the president for legislative affairs. Welcome, Caroline.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for joining us in the studio this morning. Chief of staff. Chief of staff, deputy chief of staff, special assistant to the president. One might say, what's an accomplished woman like you doing writing a book like this? Sounds like one woman as well is at least is doing extremely well in America. Do you ever get that argument? How often?
Well, you know, certainly, you know, there's essentially what brought me to writing this book was all the attention that was devoted to Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, which, you know, I don't discount the fact that there are cultural barriers that women internalize that make it harder for us to speak up in meetings, although I would say that often when women do, they get shouted down or ignored. But, you know, I had been a labor lawyer before I worked on the Hill, and employment discrimination and labor issues were what really drew me into the law. And I started thinking about the variety of pieces of legislation, some that I'd worked on when I worked on the Hill, including the Paycheck Fairness Act and others. And one of the things I had never really grappled with until I started doing research for Under the Bus was, why is it that we have all these exemptions? And we have a whole set of exemptions in our laws. You know, small employers are exempted from the anti-discrimination laws. They're exempted from the Affordable Care Act.
Anti-discrimination laws.
Indeed, unless the locality has a stronger law, which is true in the district. But in the federal law, it's 15 employees and above. And so small employers have basically a license to discriminate. And that really plays out in a lot of different ways. And what I think, you know, was really eye-opening to me is I started to think about writing something that actually explored the issues that most women face as opposed to the small elite where leaning in is the main main issue for them.
And tell us exactly what you mean by leaning in.
Well, leaning in is in Sheryl Sandberg's book, she identifies that women often hold back and, you know, sort of need to develop self-confidence and leadership. It's sort of a self-help book in many ways. And I thought, well, self-help is fine for a very small group of women battling to be the CEO of a major Fortune 500 company or something. But really, does leaning in help, say, Betty Dukes? She was the lead plaintiff in the Walmart case. And she's was a really brave woman. She worked for many years at Walmart. She saw white men getting promoted and paid more than her. And she thought, I deserve this too. So Betty Dukes went and asked for a raise and a promotion. And she got demoted. Her pay was cut. And ultimately, she got fired. So leaning in is pretty dangerous for a lot of women. Leaning in for a domestic worker, for a home health care aide, doesn't really apply. It's not really the issue that it faces them. It's not nowhere near the top of the list.
It's not realistic, exactly, for women to lean in because they're going to face consequences that other women might not, and they can't afford to.
Exactly. And so, you know, this sort of what was really interesting to me and depressing was that as I was looking into sort of the origins of all of these exemptions that leave domestic workers, farm workers, and a variety of other professions, many of them dominated by women and certainly dominated by people of color, why are they left on the sidelines? Why aren't they protected by these laws? And it's not too hard to find, because I started going through the congressional record and reading contemporaneous material of the during the New Deal. And it is so clear that Southern members of Congress, I mean, they said this on the record, we want to protect basically the legacy of slavery. We have workers here who are not going to join unions, and they are not going to get paid the minimum wage, and we are not going to give them overtime, and that's the deal. Otherwise, we're going to filibuster these laws.
So, in other words, President Roosevelt then was, Franklin Roosevelt was essentially one of the early politicians that threw the women under the bus in striking the New Deal.
Exactly, and he even said, you know, don't worry, your housekeepers won't be covered. So, I mean, the really biggest and most depressing piece of all of this is that we haven't fixed it. We haven't fixed it. And one of the reasons why domestic workers are battling so hard right now for, they don't get overtime, they don't get minimum wage, to even basically pay a rent or put food on the table is because they're not covered by any of these laws.
So let's look at the, let's paint the picture for what the reality is for millions of working women in America. They're not all CEOs, you know, and they're not all deputy chiefs of staff or executives in, you know, corporations and media executives and whatnot. The average woman or millions of working women in America face circumstances that were, as you say in the book, similar to circumstances that your great grandmother, Matilda Olofsson, is that
Olofsson.
She was an 18-year-old Swedish girl who came to America to start her new life at the end of the 19th century with no savings and no family to meet her, you write. And she was your great grandmother. And you compare her story to the story of a Haitian woman named Efrise, who also came to the U.S. almost a century later. And how are their stories similar?
Well, so Matilda, you know, she came and, you know, at the time, and I was a kid and I heard about her story, I thought it's sort of a romantic story. It sounded a lot like Upstairs, Downstairs. She came to Boston. She worked as a scullery maid. You know, she was in the downstairs part of the house. But she, you know, eventually she learned English. She got married. My great-grandfather was a teamster. They were white and Protestant. And so she kind of made it. But her circumstances while she was working were desperate. She was abused. She had no, I mean, certainly didn't get a fair wage, let alone overtime or a minimum wage. Sexual harassment was rampant. There was no health care. In looking into the situation, what has happened to domestic workers, and as I said, there are many other categories of workers, but that's one of the largest, fastest growing categories of workers in this country, dominated by women of color, is that they still have the exact same lack of rights that Matilda did, because they were carved out, and precisely because the Dixiecrats demanded that from President Roosevelt at the onset of the New Deal, and they said no, including Social Security at the time, which they were excluded from. So every single workplace protection, and that has continued on. As I mentioned, the civil rights laws even carved out small smaller employers. And that was, again, very explicit on the record, where members of Congress were basically saying, look, I mean, from the South, saying, you don't understand our society, and we can't have this kind of mixing. And so we have to have the right to discriminate. You know, our small, you know, you up north where you have big factories, that's one thing. And of course, factories can segregate inside the factory, right?
But, and do.
Right. So, you know, it's just, it was very depressing to see that for certain categories of workers, we've made no advances. Now, we do want to give President Obama some credit for working to put domestic workers under the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the minimum wage and overtime law.
Right. So a couple of things. So now we know about the domestic workers. Who are some of the other women that are have sort of been scripted out of these basic labor laws and rights?
Well, so farm workers are another large category. People often think those are men. A large, very large portion of them are women who are either there with their families or are alone. They're cut out of the overtime laws, and that, and getting covered by minimum wage has only been more recent. They cannot organize in a union under the protection of a law. There are also, you know, one of the anomalies of all of our protections is that they're based on an employee-employer relationship. And that seems kind of obvious to people, but we have to talk about what that really means, because there are more and more Americans, and again, many, many women and people of color who are being called independent contractors, who are being hired as temporary workers. And what that means is for an employer that you don't have to provide those benefits, that you don't that they're not protected by the law. Again, you can discriminate against an independent contractor as
they're,
opposed
they're
to
expected
an employee.
To bring their own to get their own health care and their medical insurance and all of that.
Exactly. And independent contractors aren't protected under the anti-discrimination law. So it's employees that are protected. And so there's a huge incentive for employers both to make themselves smaller, that is, the smaller you are, the less likely you are to have the Affordable Care Act or Family and Medical Leave Act. But then also the employees who are independent contractors or temps, they don't get anything.
Temps. And so what is the legal definition of employee? That seems like where the devil is and the semantics of the description of what is a legal employee.
Exactly. And it's something that, you know, we have that legal scholars certainly and people in the labor movement have identified for decades as a problem, that we don't have a kind of a realistic examination of what the financial dependency is as opposed to what the classification is. So, you know, for in many circumstances, it's very easy for employers to say somebody is an independent contractor and treat them as such, instead of, and the analysis that would look at, does this person mostly work for this employer? Does this person depend for their income on this employer? Does this person respond to orders from this employer? And so forth. And it's sort of the kind of reality test of, you know, who's really in control here? And we haven't advanced very far either in the understanding of the law or the enforcement side.
And so you said you were sort of blindly going along, helping to write these laws, unconscious almost of the fact that you were continuing this post-slavery kind of policies in legislating them contemporary law.
For example, I worked on a bill called the Paycheck Fairness Act, which is still something that Democratic politicians talk about as wanting to get passed, which would improve the enforcement mechanism for women under the Equal Pay Act. And the Equal Pay Act is based on the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is that minimum wage and overtime law, which excludes farm workers and domestic workers. So I wasn't, you know, when I was working on the Hill and working on law, and we worked on other pieces of legislation that were amendments to Title VII, which excludes small employers, I wasn't thinking about who was going to be affected by this. But actually, the main category of workers we want to protect is exactly those who we've excluded.
Because they're all sort of edited out.
They're edited out. They're the most vulnerable. They're the most abused. And the ones we should actually be thinking most about giving protections to.
And so if you're not within that strict definition of what's considered an employee, then you automatically don't have the basic rights. Now, will simply expanding the definition of an employee go towards eliminating these exploitive practices?
Well, so there's some interesting ideas. I would just say for the listeners, the place where this has come up mostly in the news of late, I think it's because of the elites are kind of interested in the story of Uber. mm-hmm. and Lyft and these car services that mm-hmm. claim to be simply a software app that people have on their phone and mm-hmm. they don't actually employ people, and even though they look a lot like a taxi company. Mm-hmm. But the issue of how they have treated all their workers as independent contractors has come to the fore because there have been a number of lawsuits that have been brought against them because of these very issues of control and economic dependency. But so that's how it's playing out in contemporary sort of media. Mm-hmm. But the reality is this has played out, you know, for low wage women and women of color, particularly, for decades. There are responses though, which go towards looking at much more universal solutions as opposed to the way we kind of slice and dice under our employment protections. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, instead of having a Family and Medical Leave Act that only applies to companies with 50 or more employees, which is unpaid leave, by the mm-hmm. way, which isn't very valuable for a lot of low-wage women, you know, we start looking at systems that are based on portability. They're more like social security, where mm-hmm. each employer, in whatever classification they want to make for the employee, pays a percentage depending on how many hours they work. This actually has been adopted as a way of paying for paid family leave in California mm-hmm. and Connecticut. It's one of the policies that European countries are looking at for how to treat part-time workers. Mm-hmm. It's a whole other category, once again, and not surprisingly, dominated by women, mm-hmm. giving them some kind of proportion of benefits based on the number of hours worked, rather than saying full-time gets benefits, part-time gets nothing.
Mm. So what percentage of the workforce do women make up? And what percentage of the electorate do women make up? And why are we still in this fix? Mm-hmm. I know the answer to those questions. They make up, but why don't you tell us?
Women are really, you know, we are 51%, mm-hmm. right? So,
and we hold up half the sky.
We hold up half the sky. And I always say, you know, of the 99%, 51% are women. So we should, mm-hmm. we really need to think about economic issues and women's issues as the same, and stop considering women's issues somehow as less important.
I mean, it's just plain stupid, isn't it? Really, to have the women who make up the majority of the population, who are raising the next generation, who, you know, basically hold up this half of the sky, to keep them overworked and underpaid. What is the thinking behind that? Is it just pure greed? And
I think we as a society have not caught up with the fact that women work. You know, we still operate under the assumption that a workplace is set up for a single white man or a single white man who's got a wife at home who takes care of everything, mm-hmm. you know, who deals with, she shops and she takes care of the kids and she cleans the house and all
of
that.
Is that true anywhere in America?
maybe in Donald Trump's house. I don't know. Actually, probably not. But it's very exceptional families that live that way. Almost no one else has that experience. Mm-hmm. And so, but we still expect that kind of be at the office, you know, 40 to 60 hours a week, no external obligations, work all the time.
Who's taking care of your children while you're taking care of somebody else's children, or while you're at the office working late?
Exactly.
Well, now, as you listen to the campaign speeches and the debates amongst the presidential candidates, are women's rights and concerns being given enough attention, in your opinion?
Well, I don't think they're being given enough attention. But I would say that on the Democratic side, they're given more attention than they are.
So Hillary's position is strong enough?
Well, it definitely could be stronger, but she's saying a lot of important things. I think she has spoken out on a number of the important issues of the moment, such as paid family leave, mm-hmm. paid sick leave, fair pay. I think, as I said, women are a vital part of our economy, which is, you know, the most obvious thing anyone could say. But I think if you look at how it breaks down and you see how dependent mm-hmm. families are on women's income, and especially for low-income families mm-hmm. where women are a major source of income, we need to actually respond to these issues as major economic questions.
What about the Republican female candidate, Carly Fiorina? What's her stance like with regard to women's?
I haven't heard much. Honestly, it seems like all the Republicans want to do is talk about Planned Parenthood and denying women access to reproductive rights. And if that's the road they're going to go down, I think that is certainly not going to endear them to the women voters of America, because I think taking away women's reproductive rights is not an avenue for a successful campaign. But I haven't heard anything about how do we address inequality? How do we make sure women are able to combine work and family? How do we make sure we have good child care in this country, which isn't just for women, for men, but it's for the children and the next generation? And you hear nothing about that, certainly from the Republican side.
Right. And Donald Trump, do I dare mention his name in the same sentence with women's rights?
It really makes me cringe to think about what Donald Trump might think about women, certainly based on what his exchange with Megyn Kelly. I don't have any great hopes for a emancipatory declaration from Donald Trump about the rights of women.
Ben Carson, who's also a Republican presidential candidate, African-American man, has he said anything that's particularly hopeful or discouraging with regard to labor laws and rights for women outside of, well, go ahead.
Well, I've been overwhelmingly disturbed by the remarks of all the Republican candidates generally, and I don't think I could identify for you any single one of them who said something that I think women should find attractive or interesting. But instead, and you know, I have to say, my organization is nonpartisan, but simply looking at the policy issues that have been discussed across the board, from reproductive rights to wages, benefits, to the role of labor unions, which we haven't really talked about yet, but they are certainly a very important piece of women's ability to have economic prosperity. And the attacks on unions have been absolutely brutal from all the Republican candidates. Of course, Scott Walker makes his name on attacking public employee unions.
Right. Well, unfortunately, we're not going to have a chance to get too much into that. We are in the middle of our summer mini pledge drive. So, but we want to thank you, Carolyn Fredrickson, author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Thank you so much for joining us this morning in the studio.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Absolutely. We're joined now in the studio by our program director, Katia Stitt, who is also a programmer here on WPFW.
And also a working woman, a working mother. And the last,
you know the story.
Yeah, all too well. Way over a 40-hour work week, but then a daughter as well. You know, a single parent, although her father is very involved and we co-parent beautifully still. You know mothers, they always do more, go above and beyond.
Yes.
That's the nature of womanhood, I think. At least here in America, this is how we see it, and probably in much of the world.
I think that's true,
yeah.
For sure.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And I thank you so much for being here, and I love that you bring in the bipartisanship on this. You know, that women, whatever we are, whether Green Party, Democrats, Republicans, Independent, wherever you, you know, it's interesting that for women, wherever you are in the spectrum, politically, you have the same challenges. Most of the time, unless you're really women of means. And even then, you have the same challenges. And so this is the kind of thing that we like to highlight at WPFW. Verna also does an excellent job always highlighting these issues. But, you know, women do hold up more than half the sky. And WPFW...
And they do it wearing heels.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, walking backwards.
That's right.
Wearing 3-inch, 6-inch heels.
But, you know, this is not a new concept for WPFW, nor for Pacifica. You know, when you think about WPFW having the oldest now women's collective here on our airwaves in the form of Sophie's Parlor. They are not on regularly, but you know that commitment to women goes way back. We see it with groups like Sweet Honey and the Rock and Bernice Johnson Regan and all that she taught us about being women balancing this act. So if you believe in this issue, if you believe in the way that WPFW, it's not a soundbite, it's not that 15 minutes of fame that we give any topic and then we move on. This is a consistent thread in our story. 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 or, of course, WPFWFM.org. Go to the phone right now. I know there are women out there listening.
That's right.
Pledge for yourselves. You know, invest in yourself.
Yes, so that we can keep this information coming to you, because unless we are able to expose these things, sunlight is the best medicine. And expose it and prick the consciousness of those listening, that's how you start to create change.
And,
in the world.
You know, we're raising girls. Mm-hmm. So they will need this. The next generation, the next seven generations of young women will mm-hmm. need this kind of information.
Absolutely.
Unfiltered, straight from a woman's mouth about what is happening with mm-hmm. women. And so it really is a vital medium of information.
Just go to the phone and make a pledge for whatever amount you choose. We have some thank you gifts that we're going to offer. In fact, we have a clip from Julian Bond.
Yes.
That Bond. Julian Bond,
right now.
that we're going to offer our listeners in honor of his extraordinary life.
Extraordinary.
And, in honor of his extraordinary life. And we're going to go to that clip now, and we'll tell you a little bit more about how you can get that as a thank you gift when you make a pledge.
So unless I support her civil rights, I'm going to find my civil rights in trouble. Everyone in America has civil rights. That's to say, there are no such thing as gay civil rights or black civil rights or women's civil rights. We all have civil rights. And to the degree that my civil rights are diminished, then your civil rights are diminished too, and hers. So unless I support her civil rights, I'm going to find my civil rights in trouble. So unless I support her civil rights, I'm going to find my civil rights in trouble. So we've got to fight and support each other, she, me, I, her, and we, all the rest of us. Because this is something involving all of us. It's not somebody else. It's all of us.
You're a legend. I hope I can follow in your footsteps and do my part.
That's right. I'm a legend of my own mind.
Okay, and welcome back to What's at Stake. That was Julian Bond articulating the need for equality of women's rights in America. He has said often that if one person's civil rights are diminished, they diminish the civil rights of all of us. Julian Bond was such an eloquent and articulate and visionary leader in our time that we have taken this opportunity in his passing to really focus on some of the highlights of his career and some of the work that he did. He was an avid anti-war activist and almost to the point where he was a pacifist. He lived his life that he was very progressive with regard to rights for everyone in America, including gay and lesbian, and I would imagine transgender individuals as well. So we've put together a package here at WPFW. Katia, can you tell us a little bit about that package?
Well, absolutely, Verna. And of course, you know, we also work very closely with the Pacifica Radio Archives mm-hmm. because they do such fantastic work. So they actually have assembled this Julian Bond package. It's three MP3 programs on one CD. And it includes Julian Bond at Princeton, 1969, Stories of the Civil Rights Movement. Then moving to 1982, Julian Bond, a speech given at UCLA in Los Angeles, slamming the war against the poor of the Reagan administration. And that particular program is entitled The National Nullification of the Needs of the Needy. And then finally, from 1997, Julian Bond at Coppin State College in Baltimore, Maryland, presenting a speech entitled Reappraising the Civil Rights Movement. So I see this as like the Julian Bond primer or primer, mm-hmm, if you will.
Uh-huh, you know? Exactly, yeah. And that's very key and important information for our generation of youngsters to be privy to, especially college students. You know, they need to understand the giants that helped to lay the foundation throughout the civil rights movement.
Absolutely, Verna. And this particular package can be yours for a pledge of $65, and so it's just a bit above your basic membership, mm-hmm. but with that you get three remarkable pieces, all speeches. And when you mention, not only college students, but you know, with our young people, with our elementary mm-hmm. school mm-hmm. and our junior high and high school children, they really need to know that the civil rights movement, as wonderful as Dr. King was, mm-hmm. went far beyond him. He was really one of the drum majors for justice, one of those foot soldiers, but certainly not the only one. We don't know enough about Bayard Rustin. Certainly not enough about Julian Bond.
Absolutely.
And in terms of civil rights, he really is a Renaissance man because he never stopped evolving, never stopped making those connections, as we heard earlier, between the XL, the Keystone XL pipeline, for instance, and the fight for civil rights.
And he started his career so early.
Yes.
He started out very young.
Yes.
I actually remember going to one of the conventions, Democratic conventions, where he was speaking, and there was just so much excitement around
him. A very
him.
Young man. Then.
Yes, yes, very young man. I think people thought at some point that he would be our first black president.
Absolutely. and but, where, well... We won't muse on that. But man, what a presidency that would be. But, you know, this kind of information and the kind of information that Verna brings you consistently every week, along with, of course,
Seema.
Yeah,
Seema. I was going to say we have a whole host
and
of
Joya, that's right.
hostesses
right?
that make up the What's at Stake team.
The collective.
Seema Sarnandan, Joya Jefferson Nuri, all three hosts of this. And we've had Fahima Sek
has
cannot
been leave
joining
her
us as well.
Yes.
So, you know, this is not just about me. I'm in the host seat this morning, but we have a whole team, and we're all committed to doing the kind of important, informative programming that will serve our audience, that will, you know, sometimes it's uncomfortable, these stories and topics that
of
we
course.
Cover, like the Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
You really don't want to hear about that all the time, but we have to cast sunlight on this in order to disinfect it, in order to energize people to be a part of a movement.
Absolutely.
We have been on this issue before day one.
And you know, as we talk about that, we always have to remember that the plight of the oppressed is always linked to the plight of the oppressor. That has been taught to us. So, you know, if we do better, believe it or not, the oppressor does too. If they do better, of course we do better. And when we say the oppressor, we mean all of those things, whether it be things that keep down women's rights, that keep down the LGBTQ community, certainly African Americans, Muslim Americans, those that look different, speak a different language than us, the Dreamers movement right now. Mm-hmm. We all boats rise when we do well. And WPFW is one of those vehicles for social change. And, that's you know, right. I would say that's through right. the four of you, you constantly are changing hearts and minds with
well,
what you do.
That's our mission, jazz and justice.
Yes.
With the emphasis on what's at stake, on justice, and the jazz through programs like yours, Katia, was this morning. It was just so hot. I will admit, I was secretly trying to sneak away to another station, but I couldn't do it. I just could every time the next piece came on. I said, I got to hear that.
Well, you know, and that's replicated tenfold here at WPFW. People, it's all about the music and the message.
So go to the phones right now and make a pledge to support the kind of extraordinary programming that we have.
Pick up that Julian Bond.
That's right. Thank you, Katia Stitt, programmer here at WPFW. You know, the rise in the number of unarmed black men killed by police across America with impunity, it seems, has given birth to what can easily be dubbed the next chapter of the civil rights movement. Black Lives Matter, a movement, not a moment, which was sparked by the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, just over a year ago, has refused to be left out of the dialogue. Black Lives Matter activists have literally snatched the microphone away from presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders, and on two occasions forcing national media to mention their cause, and for Bernie Sanders' campaign to actually present some proposals along those lines. Just recently, two BML activists confronted frontrunner Hillary Clinton at a campaign stop in Massachusetts, challenging her on policies enacted during the Clinton administration that have led to the over-incarceration of African Americans. And the issue of cop killings of unarmed blacks was barely touched upon during the first Republican debate, signaling that it's not likely to be taken seriously during the campaign season unless they're forced to. GOP frontrunner Donald Trump said it was disgusting how Senator Bernie Sanders let protesters take over the Democratic presidential candidate's rally in Seattle and vowed, "That will never happen to me." "That showed weakness," said Trump. "I don't know if I'll do the fighting myself," said Trump, "or other people will," he said at a campaign event in Michigan. What is that, a veiled or sort of a dog whistle call to others to fight the activists? Meanwhile, Black Lives Matter activist vowed to take up his challenge. Well, a trio of reporters from The Guardian launched a project to document cop killings across the U.S. The Counted is a project by The Guardian working to count the number of people killed by police and other law enforcement agencies in the United States throughout 2015 to monitor the demographics and to tell the stories of exactly how they died. John Swain, a Brit, is a senior New York reporter for The Guardian. He was portrayed in the Oscar-winning film The Killing Fields, and for many years he was a Sunday Times correspondent in Paris. While reporting on the vote for independence in East Timor in 1999, Swain barely escaped death when captured by Indonesian soldiers who gouged out the eye of his driver and were looking for a discreet place to kill him and his fellow journalists. The three journalists escaped under fire into the bushes where they telephoned their London office for help. John Swain, good morning. Welcome to What's at Stake, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me. I must just say that description, unfortunately, is another John Swain. Another John Swain is a journalist. Another John Swain is a British journalist. I'm a younger namesake of his, and haven't reported from so many places. But I am a New York senior New York correspondent for The Guardian. That's correct.
Well, thank you so much for making that correction, and we apologize for that. All right, so basically, who was the brainchild behind this project at The Guardian? What prompted The Guardian to launch this project?
Last year, I was sent to Ferguson, Missouri, after Michael Brown was killed, and our editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner, and I spoke through some of the issues that had arisen from the coverage of that case. And one, as we now all know, I think, or many of us have read about, is that there is no comprehensive count or record of people killed by law enforcement in the U.S. The FBI keeps a voluntary system where law enforcement agencies may, if they choose, submit the numbers of what they call justifiable homicides that they their officers have carried out in the past year. But apart from that, there is no comprehensive record. And Catherine Viner, our editor, thought this was slightly extraordinary given the fact that this was such an important issue in the news in the U.S. And so we decided we would try to fill that niche, to create a count ourselves. And, we appreciate that it's a mammoth task in a way, but we are giving it our best go and have been counting since the start of the year, launched the project online at the start of June, and have counted hundreds more since then.
So how many, in June it was up to what, about 500 or more?
It was more than 500 already in June, that's right. I think it was maybe 550 or so. Now it's up to 730. People are killed by law enforcement around between 3 and 4 per day on average.
People are killed per day?
Roughly between 3 or 4, yeah. Sometimes more. There have been days where 7, I think the highest day so far this year was a day in March when 8 people were killed. So more and more get added each day, and the projection, if the rate continues at the rate that it has been so far this year, about 1,100 or so people will probably be killed by the police by the end of 2015.
Now, your work documents all police killings in the U.S., not just African Americans and not just the unarmed. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. So how do you define police killings? If a person is killed in a car chase with police, is that counted?
Sometimes. So our criteria is that people who have been killed by the actions or omissions of police rather than their own actions. So someone who, for example, fled a traffic stop and drove into a wall and died would not be counted because the police would not really seem to have been contributing to that. Someone, however, such as Freddie Gray in Baltimore, who, according to the state's attorney there, died because police failed to strap him into their police van and he was thrown around in the back and broke his neck, he is included because those omissions, if you like, by the police have been credited with causing his death. So it's due to the direct actions of police officers, such as the use of a taser if someone has died often of a heart attack after being shocked, obviously, if someone is shot, that's a bit more straightforward. But people also who have been struck by a police vehicle when they themselves were not in a vehicle and killed. So we are, as you say, counting all of those cases.
Now, when you say struck by a police vehicle, you mean, like, for example, a bystander at a bus stop or something, and the police are involved in some sort of a outrageous chase scene pursuing a criminal, alleged criminal? Is that what you mean?
Possibly. I mean, that theoretically could create a case in the database. There's one I can think of, a man in Atlanta, Georgia, whose family are taking civil legal action against the police there because this man was crossing the street in Atlanta one evening, and a police car, they say, without lights, without sirens, that was far exceeding the speed limit and speeding down the street, smashed into him and killed him. So, you know, we think it's worth raising the issue of police use of vehicles, whether they're being driven safely, whether they're putting people's lives at risk, and whether indeed in some cases they have taken people's lives.
And what have you found in terms of statistics with regard to that situation in particular? Because it seems to me like I've heard that that's a pretty high level of crashes that take place in fact, I know a young woman whose mother and aunt were actually killed when police were here in the District of Columbia, when police were speeding out of control.
Yeah. Well, it's far fewer than people who are shot and killed. I'd estimate it's about a dozen or so this year so far that we have included, maybe more in the database who've been struck by vehicles, but the shootings do take up the lion's share of the database, and that, for obvious reasons, that has attracted more of the attention.
And so, the website is quite compelling. There are all these pictures of mostly smiling people engaged in life, but they are actually the victims whose lives were cut down prematurely by police. And I know that you're working on this project. You have two other individuals, journalists, I believe, who are working with you on this project. Who are they, and who's contributed to the design of the website?
We've actually just added a fourth journalist to the team. You're right. We had three until just this past week or so. My colleagues in the reporting side, Oliver Lockland, is a Brit as well. He's a senior reporter here at The Guardian. And then the two others, Jamiles Latte is an American man, an African-American man, and Kira McCarthy just joined us. She's an American woman. So we're split British and American on the reporting side. The design of this site, and as you say, the kind of striking imagery of photographs, sometimes passport-style photographs, sometimes mugshots if people had criminal records. The design of that and the whole look of the site is contributed to by a wider team. We have a photo editor who researches these pictures and obtains them from families and from law enforcement departments. We have a team of interactive designers who code and who built this kind of interactive database that we have. And so it's a real team effort. Roughly split, I'd say, among Americans and Brits in the Guardian's New York bureau.
Mm. Now, you don't just document African-American killings by police, but what is the statistic? You do, however, investigate and document how many African-Americans and whites and Latinos, I would imagine. So what is the statistic of how many what's the percentage of blacks killed by cops versus whites, Latinos, and Asians?
We do count those things. As you say, we count several data points, such as the race of the person involved, the age, the exact location of where it happened, the department, the officer, the officer's ethnicity, and so on and so on. And in terms of the people who were killed, the last time I checked, about 28% of those in the database were black people, and only about 13% or 14% of the U.S. population is black. So African-Americans are far overrepresented in these, among these people who've been killed by police. About half of the total people killed were white, but much more than half of the U.S. population is white. I think something like 63% of the population is white. And so, if you like, in crude terms, white people are underrepresented in these statistics. So I think those kind of figures really shed a bit of light on why Black Lives Matter and why other associated activist groups are arguing that this is a particular emergency for African Americans, that this is an affliction on a certain group of Americans in particular. And that's why I think often at these protests, often when they are taking the mic at these political events, when people counter Black Lives Matter with All Lives Matter, these protesters say, you know, that's missing the point. They would not deny, you know, in isolation that obviously all lives matter, but their protest is about Black lives because this is, they say, a particular emergency for Black people in America.
Mm-hmm. Speaking specifically to this disproportionate percentage, that you say 28% of the Black people killed by police are 28% of the people killed by police are Black, but they only represent 13% of the population, whereas 50% of the people of the white people are killed by police, but they represent far more than 50% of the population.
That's right.
So are there any cases that stand out as particularly egregious, in your opinion, John Swain?
I think rather than saying that they're egregious, I would say there are particular cases that stand out to me as questionable and were much worthy of much more investigation. And one of the surprising things that has struck me is, you know, we're a year on now from what happened in Ferguson, where an unarmed Black 18-year-old death caused such outrage, such debate and dispute about what happened. And yet, a case I stumbled upon in Southern Virginia, a young man called William Chapman, he too was an unarmed Black 18-year-old. He too engaged in a brief struggle with a police officer. This one was actually in the parking lot of a Walmart. William Chapman was suspected of shoplifting. We still don't know if he actually stole anything. And after this brief struggle, the police officer, just like in Ferguson, claimed that William advanced towards him, was aggressive and threatened to overpower him. And so this officer shot William Chapman dead. And what struck me was surprise that this case had not attracted more attention.
Well, was anyone filming it? That, unfortunately, you know, with the
yeah.
advent of social media now, that has been sort of the reason that a lot of these cases have now come to the forefront and to the national attention, because somebody had a cell phone and was actually recording the encounter. Or is it the case in the young man that was in the Walmart store that was shot and killed? He was on the phone talking to his girlfriend at the time. That he was actually shot and killed. So, I mean, those things lend to whether or not these cases get a little bit more exposure. Now, there were two Atlanta cops who were charged with murder after using stun guns that you have documented on your website. What exactly happened in that case?
I have to say, I haven't been following the Atlanta case because that has actually fallen outside of our remit of this year. I've been focusing on so many cases in 2015 that this case was, I believe, in 2014. But certainly with the cases of stun guns, these implements are often described as non-lethal or even less lethal, but studies have shown that they do frequently contribute to people's death, and often police seem to be using them with impunity when people often are high on drugs or drunk on too much alcohol. Studies have shown that using a stun gun, a taser, in those cases is particularly dangerous, and yet officers continue to use them. And we see these cases where people have they turn out to have had a heart condition, and they are killed from a heart attack because they've been struck by a taser. Often people are tasered again and again and again, and these shocks to the system are just too much, and people die. And so this is something that we hope to bring out more in our reporting of this year, in which tasers should be seen as a lethal weapon in many cases.
And how many of these people were in the process of committing crimes when they were killed by police? Not that something like shoplifting or petty thievery should be a death sentence by any means, but were a percentage of them shot because they were robbing a bank or in a shootout with the police or threatening to set off a bomb in a public place?
Yeah, I mean, lots were, and I'd probably estimate around half the people were. That, as you said, some of these offences range from petty things to major things. There are some people in this database who were fugitives, who were armed and engaged in shootouts with the police. However, that spans right back to people who were maybe stealing from a grocery store and were unarmed, and during their attempt to escape, engaged in a scuffle with police and were killed. And so what we've tried to do with this project is tell the full story of the full context of what happened in every case. And so rather than just use this as a list of names, mm-hmm. each person in the database, if the user clicks through, there's a summary of exactly what happened, whether or not they were committing a crime, whether or not they were armed. And, you know, we think, as I think I may have mentioned earlier, we certainly don't think that all of these people in this database were faultless, were completely innocent, were doing nothing wrong. Some were, and that's clear, but we think that the lack of this comprehensive count on the part of the U.S. government shows that there is a real need for this full accounting so that people can know and can work out how many people are being killed when they are carrying out crimes and when they're not, so that we can see whether this is as big of a problem as people are alleging.
So are any government agencies requesting your information, your documentation that you know of?
Well, we've heard and we've read the Wall Street Journal and NBC in the past couple of weeks have both produced articles which said that the Department of Justice has been following our project and a similar project to the Washington Post, which focuses on police shootings exclusively. And apparently the statisticians at the Department of Justice have been monitoring these projects. And so that's encouraging to us. We think, you know, if they take a look at these projects and perhaps come away with the conclusion that this is a possible thing that can be done, you know, this is feasible, perhaps they'll look and learn from our investigations and come away with ideas of their own for how the government can count. Because plenty of senior figures from President Obama to recently departed Attorney General Eric Holder and the President's White House Policing Task Force have all said that this just cannot continue. There must be full accounting and full data from which to base policy decisions on this subject.
Mm. Okay, and so very briefly, because we're running out of time, how do you assure accuracy in your accounting?
Well, in terms of that, it comes down to fairly traditional reporting methods, you know, making the calls to police departments and law enforcement agencies, making phone calls to families to check details of what happened in these cases, making public records requests so that we have police reports on the incidents that led to these shootings. And sometimes it's imperfect. Sometimes we are alerted to these cases by local media reporting, and sometimes that local media reporting has been based on a account from police that turned out to be faulty. And so we are constantly striving for better and more accurate information, and we a large part of the project, in fact, is informed by readers. They, through a tip system on the website, can send in more information. And on several occasions, we've had relatives of people who died write in to us and say, well, you know, the way you've described it is true to a point, but here's some more information that sheds more light on what happened. And so really through this traditional reporting, through crowdsourcing and through aggregating information mm-hmm. collected by other media, we're really mm-hmm. trying to perfect the information.
Okay. John Swain, who is one of the journalists, one of four journalists that are working to put together the website, The Counted. I guess the next would be a website on accountability on the part of the cops. That should be that can be the next project.
We have to go outside of our borders to get this done.
That's right. That's Katia Stitt, who's joined me in the studio now, and of course chiming in. John Swain, a Brit, senior New York reporter for The Guardian, the real John Swain. John, thank you so much for joining us on What's at Stake. Be well. So, welcome again, Katia.
Yes, happy to be here again. A fantastic program from beginning to end?
Well, thank you for that, and I have to sort of share the kudos for your program this morning as well. I just can't help, you know, can't stop talking about it. It was fantastic. Well, and people, you can still have an opportunity to call in and pledge.
That's right.
For either one of these shows. Just make a pledge to the station. I know you're probably driving home from the beach, you know.
How about that? That's a nice way to start. Not right. Those working folks. That's right. Those on vacation right now.
Pull over and make a couple of pledges to the station. Put down that margarita for a minute.
That's right. And, you're listening online. You're in the Bahamas. Right. You can pledge online.
That's right.
And we're making light of this. But, you know, the business of WPFW is serious business, Verna. And it is highlighting things like what you've highlighted this morning. In fact, that semi-definitive list, I don't know if it is the definitive one, but certainly it's a great first attempt to document all of those, you know, killed in some form or fashion in connection with some sort of police conduct.
Right, right.
Whether it's correct or incorrect, but police conduct. And it's really shocking, the number.
Yeah, at least we need to start documenting this.
Yes.
I mean, they can tell you how many parking tickets, you know?
Absolutely.
You've gotten with the flip of a switch, you know, but yet we can't get, you know, a documentation of
how many people killed
have been killed by the police.
Great information. Again, make that pledge that makes the difference. 202-588-9739 or WPFWFM.org. We have volunteers standing by, and Verna's goal this morning, a modest goal of $300, and we only do this with you. And as Verna said, you can pledge for this program after the program finishes. The important thing is that you pledge for WPFW.
That's right, 202-588-9739. And, you know, one of the thank you gifts that we have is actually a documentary, a one-hour documentary on the Watts riot of August 1965.
That's right.
Called Black August, and it's part of the fire.
Well, the fire this time is that 1 hour specifically, but it's part of the 50th anniversary of the Watts riots and in turn also part of the commemoration of Black August. Mm-hmm. And again, put together through the Pacifica Radio Archives.
And you know, what makes it so timely is that it's right here on the heels of, if you've seen that Straight Out of Compton movie.
Yes.
Which I have.
Me too.
We talked about that a little bit off. Line. But this is the historical foundation that led up to what was happening in Compton in that movie.
Right.
And so what we have now is a little clip from this one-hour documentary that actually it's a documentary of the violence and the looting in the L.A. neighborhood of Watts, prepared from field recordings made on the scene by Al Sibowitz and Walter Thompson in August 1965. It includes interviews with spectators and participants in the looting, a spokesman for the Black Muslims and for civil rights groups, and critics of the Los Angeles Police Department. And for a pledge of $100, you can get this two CD set, a special edition, the Black August 50th anniversary. We're going to hear a clip from that documentary now. We'll be right back.
From what I can gather, the stores around here that had pretty good public relations with the people in the community were not harmed. All the businesses that were terribly damaged around here were white-owned businesses. But there were many white-owned and one Chinese-owned store here, which were not touched at all. People who were looting the store, many of them, talked about poor service or returning one place down there, the liquor store, for instance. The woman said that she had gotten sour milk there, and when she took it back, the man cussed her and said that that she didn't buy it there. All sorts of grudges that they had against these merchants.
They were out chiefly to get theirs in as have-nots in an affluent society, spurred on by promises of the great society, the affluent society, the richest nation on earth, and the rest of the double talk that we hear on television and every time a flag is unfurled and a politician gets up to speak on a rostrum.
You know, our streets are filthy because the merchants refused to pay a teenager $5 to clean up. $5 in our community is a lot of money. Our teenagers don't have jobs. Don't all teenagers need jobs? Why should our youngsters be superior and be able to be hungry without clothes, without television, without car fare, not be able to go to the movies and not want it? How superior can you be?
But when you are a merchant, for example, and you have overcharged your customers can't go downtown, for example.
Okay. That last spokesperson was Marion Wright Edelman, excerpt from the documentary The Fire This Time, produced by Trevor Thomas. And for a pledge of $100, you can hear that entire 2-CD set, the 50th anniversary special edition of Black August.
That's right.
202-588-9739. We need your support, folks, in order to keep. The station is doing wonderful things. We're in our new location. Mm-hmm. We're back up to full
power, 50,000 watts, after we had been down for a long time, a couple of years at least. So we know that some of you are just coming back, but we do need your support. That is the model. That's the paradigm that we're under. Remember, support it. And we are thankful that we are, because we get to bring you this information unencumbered.
That's right. And if you appreciate the kind of information that we are able to provide for you on a weekly